It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hello, I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits, revisiting our series, The Political Editors. Today, Francis Elliott, who was the political editor of The Times from 2013 till 2021.
I don't think that other people in the world would share the view that there is mounting chaos.
Where there is discord, may we bring harmony.
We're all right!
It is time to put up or shut up.
A new dawn has broken, has it not?
This is a decisive moment for the world economy.
Now the decision has been made to leave, we need to find the best way.
Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed.
I have been repeatedly assured that there was no party.
Growth and growth.
Some mistakes were made.
Half a century of politics told by the people who wrote the first draft of history for The Times. This is The Political Editors. On this episode, Francis Elliott, political editor from 2013, on the demise of the coalition, Theresa May's Brexit years, and how Boris Johnson tried to get first Brexit and then COVID done.
It's a matter of personal regret that I couldn't persuade Ed Miliband to do a leader's interview. Professionally, it was great.
Yeah.
You know, it sold a lot of papers, kept us in coffee. When she finally decided to go, yeah, I was one of two people that she told. And he's the only person that, when I came to pay the bill for the lunch, I see that he put 40 Marlboro cigarettes on the bill.
So, Francis Elliott, let's begin at your beginning then as political editor of The Times. You returned having been a foreign correspondent in 2013, and the coalition was a new thing to sort of get your head around, formed 3 years earlier, and by 2013 it was still going.
I'd been there at its formation, just. I was aware of it as a concept. As a reality, yeah. It blew my mind. These people who I had spent a career ignoring,
the Lib Dems,
and you had spent a career cultivating,
and suddenly it all came.
I remember very early on going to a drinks at I think it was Nick Clegg's Grace and Favour apartment at Admiralty Arch, and the likes of Jeremy Brown were flocking to this new young thing called Matt Jordan. And I was political editor of the Dames. I was very much on my Jack Jones with my warm glass of wine,
yeah.
You know, thinking, maybe I should have spent more time with the Lib Dems.
But you knew the Tories very well, not least David Cameron.
Yes.
Because you'd written a biography of him.
Written a biography of Dave, yeah.
How did that affect your relationship with him? Because obviously you knew him.
Not brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, I blame Andrew Coulson quite heavily for... It's fair to say that when Coulson came in as his director of communications, access to some key sources dried up. And I think Coulson didn't want that and wanted a sort of separation and separated Cameron and his circle from the few journalists that he was prepared to talk to. So it wasn't great journalistically, but I did still know quite a lot about him and his politics and his milieu. So in some ways, it was an odd decision not to be in Parliament through that period.
So explain then your journey through journalism. I've basically been following you. You were at the Independent on Sunday, then I was at the Independent on Sunday, caught up at the Times.
Well, at the Times 2007, late Blair, early Brown, amazing story. The rise of Cameron and falling just short of an overall majority, and amazingly, I think still one of the most dramatic elections that I covered. And then Phil Webster was replaced by Rowland, and in about 10 minutes later, I went to Delhi to be the South Asia editor, which is a job I always wanted and was delighted to get, and thought I had left the lobby for good. And then was returned to the colours 3 years later, literally walked across the Wagga border from India to Pakistan, and then picked up the Cameron's mid-trip.
So your return back to the lobby was flying...
Was by Prime Minister's plane, which I think is the way that it should be done.
Presumably, while you were in India, you were watching how politics was unfolding.
Not only watching, but editions of the later editions of the book were coming out.
So there were two things that stick in my mind about your book. There was the drugs in the first edition, where you revealed that he came very close to being expelled from Eton. And then in the second, when the revised paperback came out, you revealed that he was prone to, David Cameron was prone to chillaxing.
A gold medal in chillaxing at the Chequers, like nothing more than a glass of decent red and a bottle of decent red and a yeah.
And you say relations with him weren't that good? Presumably when you left, there was still this expectation that the coalition would collapse at any time.
Yeah.
And it was still going strong in 2013.
Yes, it was. And it was, I mean, in some ways it was the coalition was at its absolute apogee, I would say, at that point.
2.5 years ago, Nick and I put party differences aside to come together in the national interest and form the first coalition government in Britain for over 65 years.
Everything this coalition government has done is there to serve one big purpose, which is to build a stronger economy in a fairer society.
From 2013 to 2015, it became, as the economy turned and started going gangbusters, if you remember that phrase, it was becoming obvious that it wasn't a partnership in any way of equals. We didn't really quite understand the extent to which Cameron and Osborne were plotting to devour their coalition junior partner, but that was what was happening.
Because you had three parties, all sort of neck and neck in terms of the news, if not the polls, you had Team Cameron, Team Clegg and Team Miliband all talking to you, wanting to lunch, wanting to brief stories, wanting to gossip about colleagues. It felt like there was just a lot going on.
There was a lot going on. Funny enough, the paper took a while, I think, to kind of cotton on to how rich those journalistic waters were.
At that point, you were still really filing for the paper rather than the web.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there was the web was still a massive inconvenience that you kind of serviced resentfully, as infrequently as you could get away with, and probably quite badly.
Sorry, everybody. Sorry about that. How did you feel politics was settling down at that point? Because there was a lot of sort of Guardian think pieces that coalitions were here for to stay forever. And
I don't think I ever thought that. It was quite a painful period in some ways. I mean, Miliband had been in the sense that, because you're right, because it was such a contested space, and Times matters during elections, right? Particularly during elections, and so there was a lot of. Oh, there was a lot of allegations of bad faith, and it was a personally awkward place to be, because you, as Times poll-ed, you're Caesar's wife, you're supposed to be above it, you're supposed to hold the ring, and that becomes very hard when you're in the middle of an election campaign.
These six pledges are now carved in stone. They're carved in stone because they won't be abandoned after the general election.
It's a matter of personal regret that I couldn't persuade Ed Miliband to do a leader's interview, and I think that was the first time that a main leader hadn't done a leader's interview. That it tells you a bit about the shifting nature of I mean, although Times matters, it didn't matter perhaps as much as it used to.
Although maybe if you had done, maybe you'd have swung it.
Well, I suppose it tells, I don't think it was a terribly good idea for them not to do it.
It tells you something about... Actually, the weird thing is, because I had similar battles, because I was at Mail Online, and Cameron did interviews. I think he did interviews a couple of times. Ed Balls did, Nick Clegg did, but Miliband wouldn't.
Yeah, he just really wouldn't.
But it tells you something about their approach to... I don't know whether it's risk or the audiences they were trying to speak to. They wouldn't even speak, not the establishment newspaper or the biggest newspaper website in Britain. A sort of lack of confidence or something.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you remember that, that campaign was really so stage managed by Cameron. I mean, well, they really got it down to a fine art of small, allegedly town halls where they absolutely packed them full of kind of narcs and ask patsy questions and then maybe take two softball questions and bundle us all out.
Taking a risk, having a punt, having a go, that pumps me up, and it's what is changing our country.
That was the sort of high water mark of Linton Crosby's. Yeah. I mean, that must have been his dream come true, and it worked. It absolutely worked.
It was extraordinary that you arrived back, thought, I really need to get to know these Lib Dems. And 2 years later, all that hard work.
Oh, dear. Awful lot of lost lunch receipts, yeah. Indeed.
Did you think that was going to happen, that the Conservatives would end up... I mean, even David Cameron seemed a bit surprised he ended up with an overall majority in 2015.
You know what it's like, Matt. You don't think terribly far into the future. Yeah. It's like, if possibly you think as far as, you know, what am I doing for the Sunday for Monday... Yeah. You try to think round as many corners as you can, but you can't really kind of future cast. So, in truth, I didn't know. I always knew that the coalition was not going to happen again anytime soon because it was so badly kind of so badly wrong for the smaller party, which had been the lesson of every coalition on the continent. And somehow they managed to convince themselves that, well, it worked out fine for Nick Clegg, right? Yeah. But not so much for his party.
And then 2015, the big electoral shock of our careers was going to be that David Cameron won a majority. And then
so
12 months later, he had to deliver on the thing he didn't think he'd have to deliver on.
So there
an EU referendum.
I did do a little bit of future casting because he had made this speech in 2013, the famous Bloomberg speech where he had committed to this and sold the pass on it. He'd convinced, against George Osborne's advice, and Osborne's worries all came true. And you could see... almost from the get-go of that administration, that this was the kind of, you know, this was the spectre that was going to do for him.
And I think we were both in Brussels when he got his deal.
I believe we are stronger, safer and better off inside a reformed European Union. And that is why I'll be campaigning with all my heart and soul to persuade the British people to remain in the reformed European Union that we have secured today.
His emergency brake in the middle of the night.
Yes.
And maybe it was because it was all quite late.
Yes.
But I remember feeling a bit queasy about it.
I was literally queasy that day because I had some sort of vile illness. But
maybe that's what was going around. But there was a sense in the middle of the night, this is not enough.
No. And it never was going to be enough. And do you remember it then? It kind of... It had already leaked in drafts, so we knew what was in it. The text was out there. They couldn't defend it because they'd always leaked. We never comment on leaks. But everybody was taking
shots. Yeah.
And then it's like, ta-da!
And then by the time we got to the campaign, nobody mentioned it again.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know.
Were you familiar with Dominic Cummings before the campaign?
I was indeed familiar with Dominic Cummings. I had known Dominic since the Business for Stirling campaign, sometime before. So I'd known him since 1999. And then he had run with James Frayne, a very successful operation against regional mayors. You know, I knew him as a sort of very smart campaigner. I'm sure he won't mind me telling this story. I remember him first. He had a brief period as IDS's chief of staff.
Oh, of course, in Duncan Smith,
In old Smith Square. And I met him for a lunch. And he's the only person that, when I came to pay the bill for the lunch, I see that he put 40 Marlboro cigarettes on the bill.
And he didn't last very long in that, did he? And he ended up turning on Ian Duncan Smith and tried to blow him up, which, you know, anyone who went anywhere near him again in the future might have learned that lesson.
Absolutely all there.
This is The Political Editors on Times Radio. Today, speaking to Francis Elliott, who was in the job from 2013 until 2021. Still to come, what he made of Boris Johnson and getting Brexit done, the impact of COVID on politics, and the moment that Theresa May got him to put a question to Donald Trump.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are.
Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
The political editors on Times Radio continues. I'm speaking to Frances Elliott, who was in the job from 2013. And now we turn to one of the more dominant figures of his time in the job, Boris Johnson.
Where do we start with him? One of the more, I need to keep on meaning to dig out, one of the more embarrassing intros I think I ever wrote was when...
That's a feature in itself.
Well, indeed. although it was a good... I think it was still a good intro on its own terms, but it was wrong. He had been sacked for lying about the Petronella Wyatt affair. It was on the backbenchers. They were scrambling around for a candidate for London Mayor. Cameron had wanted Nick Bowles to do it. Nick Bowles, I think, had cancer. There were a couple of other candidates that let him down. And so I wrote something like, the twin farces of Boris Johnson and the Tories' search for a London Mayor candidate collided yesterday as blah, 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 blah. But obviously, as we know, he got the gig. Yeah. He was the most powerful elected Tory, you know, politician. He was the pin-up boy. He was the myth was born. I've already written his political obituary three times. Fully expect to write it again.
Yes, exactly. It'll be written off again. We should, I feel obliged as part of this process, we should talk about Theresa May, although I'm very conscious that you and I worked together. It's probably the point where we were working together most closely. I was writing Red Box.
Yeah.
You were the pollhead of the Times. The period 2016 to 2019.
Yes.
Was so grueling,
yes,
and so miserable,
we've
and
all,
so relentless,
we don't
and
think
so
yes.
Totally
it's a
pointless.
Therapy session, Matt. I mean, you and I.
By the end of it, by the time she left, we were no further forwards on any of the big, meaningful questions.
Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed.
It was a horrible gig, and then as the results dropped for 2017, you know, exquisitely bad for her, for Britain, for the negotiation. Elections don't always clear the air, like,
yeah,
make things much, much worse, and that one certainly did.
And yet, on and on she went for 2 years.
On and on she went, yeah. When it was like, you know, both legs were shot off.
But the all of that stuff, the Swire Amendment and the Malthouse Compromise meaningful votes.
Too soon.
The Saturday sitting. Where we all trooped in on a Saturday, the first time since the outbreak of the Falklands.
Fourth, this may be for the convenience of the House now, although the second motion is debatable, I think it will be convenient for the two motions to be debated together so that reference to the second motion may be made in the debate, and if the second motion is moved, I will put the question or questions on that motion without separate debate.
And then we all went home again, nothing having been resolved.
Obviously meaningful votes, but then indicative votes.
Indicative votes.
Yeah, Norway, all that huge kind of nomenclature of nonsense.
And nothing happened.
Yeah. What, people got cross, that's what happened. People sat at home and just got sick to death of hearing about it.
And actually, it sort of radicalised people.
I think it did.
Weren't that bothered about politics.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that's necessarily a good thing.
No. Definitely not. Well... No.
I mean, it's good if people are interested in politics.
Professionally, it was great.
Yeah.
You know, it sold a lot of papers, kept us in coffee, which we needed a lot of.
Which we did need a lot of. And also during that period as well, we also had the phenomenon of Jeremy Corbyn. Huge high of 2017 from his perspective, followed by the worst result for 85 years. Yes. of all the things that you've covered in your political career, where does Jeremy Corbyn rank?
After leader speeches in party conference, the chief spin doctor will come down to the press floor and there's an almighty bun fight and everybody huddles around to hear the kind of briefing on the speech. You know, when X said, you know, Y, what he actually meant was Z, and then we all write up Z. So, you know, it's quite an important point of the journalistic process and a high watermark. So Jeremy Corbyn's first big speech.
We need to be investing in skills, investing in our young people. And, strong message here, not cutting student numbers.
Seamus Milne, his spin doctor, comes down and we ask him about one line, I can't remember what it was. And I just said, Seamus, does Jeremy Corbyn believe in a market economy? No, I wouldn't say that. So there is no sort of room for capitalism in the UK. Okay, we're not in Kansas anymore. This is like, you know, so the frame was just so completely different. It's almost like you never got to first base with him or his team because there was nothing to, you know, there was no lock. And so while some of the reporting of him was unfair, some of it was gentle because we underplayed how absolutely radical or kind of like non-mainstream he was in his thinking.
And what about the anti-Semitism question?
Well, I'm proud of what we did with that. I mean, Lucy Fisher, Henry Zeffman, Laura, we did a good job of reporting that awful story, I think. And I'm pleased about that, and I'm proud of that, and I'm proud of the team for what we did. You know, it was so easy to get wrong, but we didn't get it wrong. So, you know, we did it properly, early, well.
I've just realised that you're the political editor of Change UK.
No?
That
seismic moment in British.
What an extraordinary weird time that was.
Yeah.
Just which next? Oh, was Anna Soubry joining?
Yeah.
You know, Anna Soubry aside, actually, just lots of people we'd never really bothered speaking to before. Yeah. Suddenly political rock stars for
40 minutes.
Yeah, for 10 minutes. And then it was all over. So then we get to 2019 then. There's just the misery of Brexit votes and crunch moments that came and went with nothing happening. Illegal prorogation and all of that.
When the Royal Commissioners walked into the House of Lords, it was as if they had walked in with a blank sheet of paper. The prorogation was also void and of no effect. Parliament has not been prorogued.
Parliament just wouldn't vote to dissolve itself, right? And there was nothing Johnson could do about it. And I mean, you know, I'm no Cummings fanboy, but it is the case that I remember having a coffee with Cummings. I said, look, Dom, it's not happening for you. You know, they're just going to hold him there and boil him alive in all this. And pretty soon the Brexit isn't going to get done and he's going to get blamed for it and you're going to get your legs broken. Mm. And he said, no, we're just going to keep on doing it. I said, well, you know, you've done it three times. Nobody's voting again. Surely nobody's stupid enough to actually vote for this. Step forward, the late unlamented leader of the Lib Dems at the time.
Joe Swinson
and the SNP eventually took the bait, and the rest is history. So, you know, there is an alternative history where everybody, all the other opposition parties hold their nerve, and that election is not in court and in that frame because it was obvious as soon as you put that frame on.
Let's get Brexit done, my friends, and get on with our project of sensible, moderate, back tax cutting, one nation conservative.
Brexit done is one of the most inspired pieces of political messaging.
Well, I mean, it's pretty simple, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, but it appealed to everyone, apart from ultra hardcore EU beret wearing Lib Dems, who wanted us to rejoin tomorrow.
That's most of your listeners.
Everyone else.
I thought that was most of your. Anyway.
But everyone else, all the Remainers, most Remainers who just said, look, well, I think we should stay, but now we've voted, we should leave. Just get it over with.
Stay at home, exactly. I
mean, just get it done. Yeah. Stop talking about it. And then the sort of. The last chapter of your multi-chaptered story is followed. Is COVID.
Yeah, that's a miserable way to end, really.
Yeah. But a way that quite often people would accuse political journalists of over-egging the significance of their stories. And yet, actually, for the first time, it was a real life and death story that we were reporting on every day.
You hang around these kind of government spin doctors for long enough to be able to read their body language. And as the months of early 2020 progressed, it became very noticeable that the James Slack you know, he looked really haunted.
He was what by then Director of Communications.
Director of Communications, yeah. for Johnson, had done the same job under May. Obviously a key source if you're a pilot of the Times. And without kind of like, you might want to stock up on, you know, bog roll, you started to get the vibes. And I remember coming back one day and saying to my wife, I said, this is like, I think this whole COVID thing is like a lot more serious than they're letting on. And she said, oh, we should stock up. I said, don't be ridiculous. What are we going to do? Chuck the tins of beans at the zombies as they come over there? Anyway, that's something that has been held against me.
So. Well, I remember I came into this building, into the news building, to have photos done for the Times Radio, which is imminent launch. And it was like a beautiful sunny day. And I thought, well, I might go over to Westminster. I thought, oh, no, I won't. I'll go to Westminster tomorrow. And I didn't come into London for 3 months. You just felt it slipping, and then it all happened at once.
Lovely Chris Smythe, the Whitehall editor. I remember switching the lights out at the Times room. Chris really was much further ahead down the mental journey on COVID because he had been a former health editor. Said, well, we won't be seeing this for a while. The next time, there'll be creepers growing up the walls. He said, but he wasn't far.
Well, of course, Chris's story is brilliant because he was the health editor of the Times for years and moved to the lobby to get away from health stories and ended up becoming essentially COVID editor.
COVID editor for 3 years, 2.5 years, yeah.
I urge you, at this moment of national emergency, to stay at home, protect our NHS, and save lives.
When did you decide you wanted to do something else?
Yeah, the truth of the matter is, I had made myself a promise at the height of the Brexit, all that misery, that I was never doing this again. You know, I just reached a point in my life where, you know, to do that job is—it's a huge privilege and a massive honour and all that of it. But it is at least 12 hours a day of being switched on, thinking about nothing other than politics. And that became 16 hours a day during Brexit. And I think, you know, I think the pandemic put a spoke in a lot of wheels and just thought, you know.
And in terms of your relationships with those people over time, you know, the highs and the lows, and like you said, being the political editor gives you access and people want to speak to you. Did you get on with the various prime ministers that you covered during your period?
Of our highs and lows. I mean, funnily enough, the one that I probably did weirdly... So my relationship with David Cameron was complicated by the fact that, you know, I'd written the book, the bits of it he didn't like, but he knew that I knew if anybody was going to explain his political journey, you know, it was James Hanning and I, because
you'd done it, book. Right? Yeah.
But we were never, you know, he never had me in for cosy chats. None of them ever did, right? But the one, funnily enough, I didn't have a relationship with her, but Theresa May was good to me. She was all right. You know, there were little things like I got a question at the Donald Trump presser, which you know, is really in her gift.
And we'll have no problem with that, okay?
Francis.
Mr. President, Francis Elliott from The Times. Do you agree with your ambassador that the entire economy needs to be on the table in a future trade deal, including the NHS?
Look, I think everything with the trade deal is on the table. When you're dealing in trade, everything's on the table. So NHS or anything else, or a lot more than that, but everything will be on the table, absolutely.
I'm proud of that. I'm proud of getting to say that the NHS was on the table. And when she went, when she finally decided to go, you know, I was one of two people that she told. I think history will be reasonably kind to her because I think that it is obvious that there was little else she could do. And she was trying to stop this country from making a historic mistake. And failing.
Future pollets will report on whether or not she was right.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Francis Elliott, thank you so much for joining us. This trip down memory lane for the political editors on Times.
One day we'll do the real story.
Yeah. I'll stop recording.
That was Francis Elliott, political editor from 2013 to 2021. In the final episode, we'll hear from Stephen Swinford, the current political editor of The Times, about the biggest stories he's covered, from the pandemic to Partygate and the fall of Liz Truss. His episode, along with the entire series, is available wherever you're listening to Politics Without the Boring Bits. But for now, from me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.